The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Greetings to everyone today. Good to be here. My message today, cowboy up. That's Montana talk for man up or be a man. Let's go to Isaiah 3, if you will, to begin today. In 1956, there was a unique show, a game show that played on television for 25 seasons, and it was called To Tell the Truth. Three men would get up and claim to have a unique profession or life experience, something exceptional, and four celebrity contestants would then ask them questions. And the ones who were not the real person could lie, but the one who was the real person, he couldn't lie. And then they would try to guess who it was. And at the end of the show, or the end of this particular part of the show, the announcer would say, "Will the real so-and-so please stand up?" And then that individual would stand up. And so today, I kind of want to follow this and ask a similar question. In our age, I think many men are abandoning their masculinity. And so today's question I have for us today who are men in God's church, will the real men stand up? Will we stand up and be real men? Because I've been kind of shocked here in Montana, to tell you the truth. It's wintertime now, and I go pull in the gas station. I see somebody will pull in. The lady will be driving. The man's the passenger. She gets out, gets the gas, and cleans off the windows, and he just sits there doing nothing. Never seen anything like that. In the summertime, I'm driving down the residential streets, and I'm seeing the ladies on their tractor mowers out there on an acre of land mowing the lawn. You know, I see them doing that. I hardly see any men doing it, it seems, sometimes. And so my point is, I see so few men really doing work, hard work. And I've always thought, you know, about women. And I'm prefacing this because I want to talk about the movement in America towards a feminized society. But I want you to think for a minute, because I do think about this. What a terrible place the world would be without women. I don't know if you've ever thought about that. But our homes would probably be, if it was just men on the earth, probably be like caves. We'd all be eating out of a Campbell's soup can or something, you know, with a spoon and not using a plate. There wouldn't be any window treatments, you know, there wouldn't be flowers, you know, like we have. It just wouldn't be the same. It wouldn't be the beautiful place. And women have their own kind of strength. They do. They're self-sacrificing. They are nurturing with their families. And they make the world a lot safer, a lot softer, and a lot more enjoyable. The problem, though, is that something has developed with men in America today. They're becoming more like women. There's been this slow, steady movement of feminization that has moved across America, and it has gained tremendous traction when it comes to the feminist movement. Now, when this group first started, I was fairly supportive of it because they were claiming that women should have equal pay for equal work. Made sense to me. They should have respect in the workplace. They should have equal status. And I believed in that. However, today, this whole movement has just spun completely out of control. Today, anger and hatred are voiced towards men, and it's developed and getting worse and worse. Now, I don't blame a lot of women because men have frankly wimped out in many cases. However, today, there's so many books that are written that are just plainly hostile and anti-men on the shelves. You know, I went to Amazon.com this week and looked it up. There were over 70 books openly hostile to men. I'm just going to name a few so you get the idea. Why Men Are Clueless. Are Men Necessary? How to Get Stupid White Men Out of Office. Why Women Should Rule the World. Men Are Not Cost-Effective. The Natural Superiority of Women. The Fragile Male. The Decline of a Redundant Species. Why I Hate Men. Ditch the Jerk. That bad man is easy to find. He's just no good for you, and get rid of him. And that's just part of 70 books that are against men today. And today, men, you see them ridiculed openly on the electronic media, that is television and movies. When I was young, I watched TV shows that were wholesome. I watched Ozzie and Harriet. I watched series like The Cleaver Family, you know, Leave It to Beaver, you know. And there the fathers would deal with some sort of family problem, and they would be the ones that would be counted on to resolve the problem, and they would do so with dignity, with fatherly strength, and with wisdom. Modern television, they've turned that completely around today. The trend today is to portray husbands as bumbling losers. They're sometimes self-absorbed, kind of Archie Bunker types. Then on the flip side, they're depicted as clueless Homer Simpsons. Strong men, you have to admit, are often pictured by our media today as ignorant and brutish. Educated, enlightened men are shown to be kind and sensitive. You know, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy helped men not be homophobic. You know, that was a wonderful advancement in TV. At the same time, if you notice that many successful movies today have superheroes that are women. And these women can outthink and outfight any man. And they are the heroes of the movies. And for example, you remember Angelina Jolie in Tomb Raider, Charlie's Angels, things like that. And today, most of the leading men are what? Pretty boys, aren't they? Mel Gibson played in an unusual comedy that I thought was fairly funny, but it was entitled What Women Want. But it had a theme definitely woven throughout that movie. Here was Mel Gibson as a macho executive type. He loses his promotion to a female coworker, and the reason for his loss is clearly made apparent in the film. He just doesn't understand. It's now a woman's world out there. And the film offers only one way that he can possibly redeem himself, and that is he has to come to think like a female. And that's the theme of this movie. So the movement toward it being a woman's world has had a profound effect on many men in our country today. You know, I read an article in which Detroit area police wore pink on National Anti-Bully Day. And clothing and hairstyles, you know, have become unisex. You've seen that. And that's happened so much today. And now we have developed, like on, American Idol, we have what they call the metrosexual. It's a straight man who is feminized. He's become obsessed with his appearance, and he daubs on makeup and gets cosmetic surgery. And this is what's happening to men all across America. And so we see that women have filled the void. That is, they've become head of businesses, they've become head of churches, and they've become heads of their home. They serve in military operations today, and now the women's vote can actually sometimes turn an entire election to determine who our president is today. You know, years ago I entered the field of air conditioning, and I worked in it for 25 years, and I was in repair and remodel and construction in that industry. And when I started as a young apprentice, I reported entirely to facilities managers that were all men. Well, I worked for 25 years, and by the time it came time for me to retire, I was reporting almost entirely to women. They had taken over the field, and they should have taken over the field because men had wimped out. Because I would call Honeywell and ask for someone to help me, and I would get an engineer that was a woman who could give me exact details on how to calibrate a type of control. I would call people that were women, and they would call me back, and the men I would call would just let it go. You know, you had to come to them. And so we left ourselves open as men, and the women were working harder. They were trying to establish themselves in the world because men weren't supporting them anymore, because the men had wimped out. And this is my issue today. It's had such a profound effect on American men, slowly but surely, but it's happened, and we've come to a point you would have never believed 10 years it would ever occurred. Men have opted out of being men. And this, to me, is demonstrated very much by a song that was in 72. This is when it was really starting and really starting to roll and make an impact on America. The songs in 72 is a rock song called "Oh Girl." Do you remember that? "Oh Girl." And the lyrics stated this: "All my friends call me a fool. They say, let the woman take care of you." What? That's the opposite of the way it should be. But this kind of thinking has revolutionized our society. A national survey that I looked at, I think you, Terry, had said in your message on the world to come that half of the kids are born, but I read it was like a third are fatherless. And so many homes today, the woman is being both the husband and the breadwinner and the mother, and they're having to take care of everything because men are not taking care of their responsibilities, even if they get somebody pregnant. You know, they just walk, and the woman raises the children alone. You know, it's so funny that we used to believe in spare the rod and you'll spoil the children. But we don't spank our children anymore. We don't do that. We never think of it. We're supposed to talk to them, you know, just talk to them like they could really understand, you know. So we make in our schools, we find that boys behavior is sometimes outside the lines. And so instead of correcting it, what we do is we just prescribe Ritalin. And that's what's happening in our society today. We're emasculating manhood, emasculating masculinity, if you will, and men in general. And what's happened as a result is in our society, we have become preoccupied with our rights instead of our responsibilities. We strive to develop self-esteem and not character in our children. And it's led to people, young people, feeling entitled even when they're incompetent because of our approach that we've taken. It's led to the now famous failure to launch syndrome. You understand what that is. 30-year-olds who haven't left home, they're still living with their parents. And all of this, I think, is having a dangerous and very perverse effect on our society in general. And, of course, it rubs off on the church. And we've seen it in the society. You read the Fox News or you read the newspaper or you see the news in whatever form you do, and you see increasing drug use just going spiraling out of control. And now we're watching the Occupy protests, abuses of every sort, crime and welfare dependency, and we are fulfilling this ancient prophecy in Isaiah 3 in verse 12. "For as my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead you cause you to err and destroy the ways of your paths." Isaiah's talking about us today. This is us today. All of us simply grow up immersed in the social system that we find ourselves in, all the culture that we're raised in, and we're affected by it, not even realizing. Let's go to Ephesians 5, if you will. But I say this, it is time for men in God's church to realize how important masculinity is. Really is. It's time for us to stand up and be real men, to be the men that God designed us to be. You know, God came down on this earth. He didn't just command and have a man be made, but he actually took the soil in his own hands and he formed man in his image, lovingly, and then personally breathed life into him. And you have to understand that God had a very important plan for mankind, making him in his own image. And he set high standards for man, and he had great expectations for man. They were to be leaders in the society. God created a hierarchy for this purpose, and it says this in Ephesians 5 and verse 23. Ephesians 5:23, "For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything." However, what happened was men read this and they misinterpreted their high calling is what they did. Too many cases, men twisted these verses and they thought that they were in a privileged position in the family, and they believed sometimes that they could be tyrannical, and the woman just had to accept it because he was the head of the house, and I can be unreasonable, but I still have to be obeyed. And so men went off on their wrong track. Many thought they could be selfish, and it was up to the wife just, well, get used to it, adjust to it, you know. But that was never God's intent, never his intent. No, a man has an office given by God for the purpose of being the Savior, the protector, and the provider. And so he says, continuing here in verse 25, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church. And he gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing. And men today, I've seen them degrade their wives. You know, I've seen them talk wrong words to them and criticize them. They're not supposed to do that. We're to present them to ourselves as a beautiful, glorious thing with no spot or wrinkle. But it should be holy and without blemish. That is the church. So my point is, look, as we roll into the end of the age, we really need to take a look at this, because all of men are being affected in our society, and all of that is having its impact on the church of God. And so we've got to consider what our culture has done to masculinity, and we've got to strive to be God's men, real men. If we want to be real men, we have to think about something. We have to know something first. What is a real man? You see, a lot of people don't even realize today what a real man is. Dr. Laura Schlesinger said this once, "I cannot tell you how many times I've had to remind men that they are men. It's not about biology. It is about strength, will, honor, courage, leadership, sacrifice, and compassion and love." That's pretty well stated, isn't it? Let's go to 1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians 15. All the men in God's church need to be what God intended us to be. And this, I think, is really vital as we get closer and closer to the end of the age. You know, and there is an example for us of what a real man is. And it's inlaid in the scriptures here. You know, I want you to think about this. From the beginning, man did this the wrong way. Adam failed. He failed. He let his wife lead him, and he followed her, and then when God questioned him, what did he do? He blamed the wife. He wasn't a man. He didn't stand up for what's right. He didn't do what God intended for man to do and to be. In 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 45, he sent his own son to show us what a man is supposed to be. In verse 45, and so it's written, the first man, Adam, was made a living soul. The last Adam was made a quickening spirit. That is, the last Adam was Jesus Christ. He was the first man to live the way that God intended a man to live, and he attained the resurrection. And he's the pattern. He's the captain of our salvation. He's the one that we're supposed to follow. He's our example. And so we have four Gospels, and those four Gospels are written to show us who this being was and what he was like and how he lived. What he was like is what we should be like. And so we need to see these four different sides of Jesus Christ that are portrayed in these four Gospels. And we need to seriously consider them. Let's go to Hebrews 8 for a minute. Hebrews 8. These different Gospels are different. First three synoptics and John, a different Gospel. But Matthew portrays Christ as the King of the Jews. He portrays him as the one who has fulfilled the prophecy of that coming Messiah who would be their king. Mark was a servant, and he portrays Jesus Christ as a servant. Luke showed Christ as a human, having a human side. And he, in his gospel, which is longer, includes all mankind, and he's the one that speaks more than any others about women and their role as Christians. John, the deeper gospel, depicting the depths of Jesus Christ. This same depiction of Christ is actually foretold or foreshadowed in the tabernacle in its setting. In Hebrews 8, it starts here in verse 1. Now these things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such a high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of majesty in the heavens. He's a minister of the sanctuary and the true tabernacle which the Lord pitched, and not man. For every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices, wherefore it's of necessity that this man have somewhat also to offer. For if he were on earth, he would not be a priest, Christ wouldn't, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law, who serve under the example and shadow of heavenly things. And so this tabernacle and the priesthood was all foreshadowing things that are heavenly and spiritual. As Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle, for see, he says, that you make all things according to the pattern showed thee on a mount. And so now he's obtained a more excellent ministry by how much he is also a mediator of a better covenant and established upon better promises. And so what we see here is that the tabernacle that was created was made after a pattern that God commanded. It was made to be a certain way. That ancient tabernacle, if you go to Numbers 2 real quickly here, Numbers Deuteronomy, in Numbers, it talked about the numbers of the various tribes as they sat around this, as they were established around the tabernacle. And it says, every man of the children of Israel shall pitch by his own standard with the ensign of his father's house. Far off about the tabernacle of the congregation shall they pitch. And so everyone was to have an ensign. And the book goes on to show that it was Reuben on the south side with his, and Judah was on the east with his ensign, and Ephraim was on the west side with his sign, a symbol, and an ensign, and Dan was on the north side. And so it shows that there were the tabernacle, and then on this side there were three sets of tribes, on this side three, on this side three, and on this side three, making 12 tribes of Israel, and each one of those tribes had an ensign that stood for that section of the tribes. Now, these ensigns represented also the four sides of Christ, just like the Gospels did, because they were picturing things that were heavenly. Now, the expositors, Bible commentary explains, Jewish tradition suggests that the tribal banner corresponded in color to the 12 stones in the breastplate of the high priest. Further, this tradition holds that the standard of the tribe led by Judah had the figure of a lion, that of Reuben, a figure of a man, and of Ephraim, the figure of an ox, and of Dan, the figure of an eagle. Now let's go to Revelation 4. There at Revelation 4, we see Christ, and we see him sitting on his throne in heaven, and we see something really unique here as we read this in verse 6. And before the throne was a sea of glass like unto crystal, and in the midst of the throne, round about the throne, were four beasts full of eyes before and behind. And the first beast was like a lion, the second beast like a calf, and the third beast had a face of a man, and the fourth beast was like a flying eagle. And the fourth beast had six wings, and they are full of eyes, and they rest not night or day, saying, Holy, holy, Lord God Almighty, which was and is to come. So you see the point. This is the heavenly face of a lion, an ox, a man, and an eagle. And what we see is that same pattern when it was in the tabernacle. It was a picture of what the heavenly throne is all about and what it looks like. Now, the early church understood this, and Irenaeus wrote in his work Against Heresies in Book 3 this, For the cherubim, too, were four-faced, and their faces were images of the dispensation of God. He's referring to, I think, Ezekiel in this, but it was the same symbolism. Their faces were the image of the dispensation of the Son of God. The first living creature was like a lion, symbolizing his effectual working, his leadership, and royal power. The second was like a calf, signifying his sacrificial and sacerdotal order. But the third had, as it were, a face of a man, an evident description of his advent as a human being. The fourth, like a flying eagle, pointing out the gift of the Spirit, hovering with his wings over the church, and therefore the Gospels are in accord with these things among which Christ is seated. And what he's saying is that there is a matchup here, and that these were four perspectives in the Gospels, and these beings that surround him on his throne are picturing those four perspectives of Christ, the perfect man. And so it was that these are images of our Savior that we can look at and see what a real man is like. We can look at the Gospels and look at these images and see what real masculinity is about. The powerful lion, it portrays his messianic and kingly rule. He's noble. He's royal, respected. He is His Majesty on high. The lion is powerful. The lion is sometimes ferocious, but the lion exhibits courage. He doesn't faint easily. He doesn't wimp out. He's unafraid. He always acts in a manner that conveys dignity because of a kingly role. It's a figure of a king, and the king executes justice and righteous judgment. Matthew 26. Matthew 26. Here is Matthew, what is called the gospel that is reflected by that lion, Matthew 26. And it portrays Christ as the son of Abraham and David, and it's associating him with the king that was to come and the laws and the kingdom. And Christ enforces the laws and he fulfills prophecy. And when you see Christ in this gospel, what do you always see? You see him always leading. Even when the religious leaders attacked him, he was in charge, and he confounded them every time. And we see him not taking anything from them and cleansing the temple and overthrowing it. You see the ferocity of the lion in this account, and you see him uncompromising with the truth. He said, "No one takes my life. I lay it down as a conscience act that I take, that I've decided to do." He was the representation of the truth. He thought the truth. He lived the truth, told the truth. He was uncompromising when it came to obedience to God. And this is one of the very most, I think, important sides, at least one of the first of the important sides of Christ and what it is to be masculine. This is what God has called men to do and be. To be like this, to be a leader. This is the manhood he's given us. And so the husband is to be the king priest in the house over the family. And he is to be a protector of what is right. And that's why God gave men authority in the family. It was not to take advantage of a woman, not to use her for his own purposes, but it was to protect and guard God's way of life, to be the leader in that life, to lead by example, and to be the one who defends the family from what's outside. We see this over and over again in the example of Christ, the king's actions. Remember in the Garden of Gethsemane, you know, he faced what was probably one of the greatest trials of his life. Every man, every one of us, we face these times. A time when we know we're in danger. A time when we know we're doing the right thing could hurt us. All of us face that. But many times, men will try to go around it. They'll try to get through it. They'll try to avoid it. But Christ didn't avoid it. He didn't wimp out. With enormous pressure, he never flinched. Matthew 26 and verse 42. For I was 26 and 42. He went straight away again the second time and prayed, saying, "Father, if this cup may not pass away from me except I drink it, your will be done." That's what men are to be like. When we're tempted, when there's sin involved, when there's a problem or a conflict, we are to say, "Thy will be done." How many times do we not say it? How many times when we're pressured do we not say, "Your will be done," but we do our own will? but someone who is kingly, someone who's royalty, someone who is like Christ in this respect, with dignity, faces danger and goes through it and deals with it and handles it the way God would. Thy will be done. He accepted his responsibility to fulfill God's plan for him and his life, and he executed that plan so that he could be our Savior and gave himself for his bride. That's nothing like the modern world today, is it? Like the modern men today. January 13th this year, Francisco Schettino, captain of the Costa Concordia, he decided to break from his directed plan, from where he was supposed to go. His ship hit a rock and began to sink, killing at least 15, I think, and dozens more that are lost. The captain fled the ship, and you know what he said? Oh, I tripped and fell into a lifeboat. Can you imagine such a thing? The Coast Guard ordered him to return and help evacuate the people on the ship, but he feared to do so. He's now facing manslaughter charges. That's what's happened to men today in our world. They opt out when there's danger. They flee to save themselves instead of protect the others. You understand? We've got to be men of God, and we've got to do the right thing. And I ask you to think about this for a minute. Christ is the captain of our salvation. He is the captain of our ship. He never leaves us or forsakes us, does he? He paid whatever personal price it took to do the right thing. And men and husbands are to be the captain of their family ship, if you will. And we've got to follow God's plan for our journey through life. You know, when things go wrong, when we make a mistake, we face it, we accept it. We don't abandon ship. We don't abandon our responsibilities. We don't do it. We are to defend our wives and children as the king of the family. We're to guard them from the filth that's in this world. We protect our daughters from some young men with wrong intentions, don't we? They may not like it, but that's what we do, you know. We protect our family, and we protect our kids, sometimes from themselves, but always from this undisciplined society we're living in. And so we make rules for them, and sometimes those rules make us unpopular, but we hold fast to them because they are principles of God, and we don't abandon those principles. Because that's what a real man is, and that's what Christ shows us in Matthew. Proverbs 14. Proverbs 14. There's another aspect of being a man that the Gospels really reflect. And the next book is the book of Mark. And in Mark, he was a servant. And so we see that man, a real man, is someone who is a servant. And so the Gospel of Mark reflects this side, and that is the side that is the ox. And he speaks to us in terms, when we read his book, we hear words different than we hear in the other Gospels. We hear the word anon, or the words immediately, because as a servant, that's how he thought. And we see this is to the point. It's a shorter Gospel. It's very pragmatic and very practical in its way of being presented. And so he presents this other side of Christ that the angelic beings picture, and that is of an ox, and it portrays an untiring strength. And so it says that we, the symbolism tells us that we are to be people who work. Proverbs 14:4, where no oxen are, the crib is clean, but much increase is by the strength of an ox. And this is a side that we should imitate of Jesus Christ. He was a carpenter. And that term in those days, a carpenter, was really a contractor, a general contractor. That means he would work with the rock, he would work with the stone, he would lay the foundation, he would put the walls up, he'd put the roof up. He did it all. And so he was a big, tough guy. I mean, he was strong. He was rugged. He had muscles. And he worked all his life until he started his ministry. He was masculine appearing and rugged. And he said this, I work and my Father works. He is represented by the ox. Never too tired, never too busy to help others. Christ worked so hard, he slept through a storm. Well, the disciples weren't, but he was so exhausted, he slept through it. He prayed all night sometimes because these things were so important. And he said, I must work while it's still light. I've got to get the work done. It's my meat to do the Father's will, he said. And he came to earth to be a servant. Luke 22. We're a very famous verse here in Luke 22 and verse 27. For whether is greater, he says, he that sits at meat or he that serves? Is not he that sits at meat, that is in our world, but he said, I'm among you as he that serves. And so Christian men, real men, are to follow that example. That's why we were designed with such broad shoulders and bigger arm muscles than women. That's why we have big leg muscles. We're created to plan and to work that plan and bring it to fruition. But today, they're saying, let the woman take care of you. And this is flat out wrong. And it is emasculating people, men across our culture. And so there are people that don't work to provide for their family today. And I'm not talking about they're having a difficult time, because I know the economy's rough and I know getting a high-paying job is hard to do today. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about people that refuse to work. You know, there was a man that came to Donald Trump. He told this story on television. I thought it was really interesting. There was a man that came to Donald Trump, and he wanted a job, and so he gave him his application, and Trump said, okay, I'll accept you. I'll give you the job. And the guy said to him, well, can I start next month? Because my benefits for unemployment haven't run out yet. So he wanted to continue taking his vacation on government funds, and Trump said, you're out of here. You're fired, his famous saying. But you understand my point. What's happened to us that we don't want to work and provide for ourselves? What's happened to men? How do we get here? I want to take an extra month. I don't want to start because I still have my benefits and I can live off that and play and vacation. That's not manly. That is not manly at all. Today, there are people that actually have trouble working because they don't like having to be under authority. I remember, I personally dealt with this. There was a man in Orange County, and he could never seem to ever keep a job. And finally, he just simply refused to work anymore. And I remember his wife had two jobs, came home, cleaned the house, cooked dinner, and his marriage and his kids' lives were ruined by all of this. And eventually, he was out of the church, worse than a heretic, if you don't provide for your family. I've watched now the Occupy protests. Have you been watching some of those? You know, some of them have gone on 4 months. Men in an Occupy, they're living in tents, out in parks, defecating on cars, burning things down. They are trying to tear our society down, and they have nothing to replace it with. They have no plan, nothing that they're going to do. What's happened to men? Don't you see it? Us, as the men of God, have to be individuals willing to work. Galatians 6. Our calling is to be men that are strong, not men who are weak. We are called to have a special office by God as provider, protector, and we are to work hard, to build family, and to build society. And for this reason, we're created stronger, so that we can be a provider, so that we can be the protector. And the scriptures state that Christ went about doing good works. And he often prayed and he often fasted, because he knew he drew his strength not from himself alone, but from God the Father. And that's what we've got to be like. We've got to be working, going about our business, doing good works, and drawing on our strength from the Father. That's our commission. That's our calling. And it's a beautiful thing about being a real man. That's our calling. Untiring labor for others. Productive. Galatians 6 and verse 9. Let not us be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially to them that are of the household of faith. And so let's use the strength God gave us to work for God and never give up the fight for the Christian hope of salvation. Strive to follow this example of Christ. Productive service in all that we do, not being lazy, but working hard, untiring service towards God. Let's go to Hebrews 2. Hebrews 2. The third gospel and the third face is an interesting one. It is the face of a man. And so when you look at this symbolism of the face of a man, it shows a relationship between God and man. God made us in his very own image. And it shows that in masculinity, in our strength, and in our labor, there is a place for compassion and for empathy. And so the face symbolizes this relationship he has with man, and it reminds us of our potential, that we're made in his image and that we have the potential to one day be God. And so he made us in his image, and we see so much that the Father actually loves mankind. But what's really important to me is to understand this. I want us to think about this. Because men go around judging and condemning and complaining and all kinds of things like that, swearing, you know, about life and because things didn't go their way, you know. Christ actually became a man so that he could understand what it's like to be a man before he judged us. That is so kind. That is so decent of him. And so humane, isn't it? And that's another beautiful side of Christ and his masculinity. Hebrews 2 and verse 14. For as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that has power of death, that is the devil, and deliver them through fear of death, who were all their lifetimes subject to bondage. For truly he took not on him the nature of angels, but he took on him the seed of Abraham. Wherefore in all things it behooved him to be made like unto his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, in order to make reconciliation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he's able to succor or help them who are also tempted. You can't tell me that isn't a beautiful aspect of our Savior, who was the most manly man who ever walked, that he had compassion on mankind and love for mankind. You know, it's interesting to me how he often showed this, you know, whereas sometimes people think today that men, if you're going to be a manly man, that you never, you know, you never cry, you know. But the face of a man shows Christ's humanity and portrays his identification with us, and it reflects his empathy and compassion towards us. And this is demonstrated in Luke's gospel, the third gospel, like the third image that is mentioned. Luke was a Gentile, and he didn't write just to the Jews like Matthew did. He didn't write just to the church like John did, but he wrote to all mankind, and he so many times referred to Christ as the Son of Man. And he included more in the case of women. I think it's interesting that his gospel is the 42nd book in the Bible. And, you know, numbers have meaning, of course. And 4 plus 2 is 6. And it pictures the number of a man. Man was born, created on the sixth day, and so on. And so 6 pictures a man. And so this is what this gospel is all about. And so 7... You can look at it also as 6 times 7 is 42, and that would be 6, the number of man, times 7, the number of completeness or perfection. And so you get the perfect man. This is Jesus Christ, the perfect man. And he exhibits empathy and compassion. Remember how he cried over Jerusalem? He wasn't crying because he didn't get his way. He was crying because he knew the pain and the suffering of the people there. And he wanted so much to be able to heal them. And he longed for when the kingdom could come and he could straighten things out and people could again enjoy happiness and wholesome lives like he intended. Jesus Christ, the perfect man, exhibiting empathy and love towards others. And so you see him healing those who came to him. And you see his heart going out to this widow in Luke 7 and verse 11. And then the Jews brought him at the feast. I'm sorry. John. Helped to be in Luke. 7, verse 11. And it came to pass the day after that he went into a city called Nain, and many of his disciples went with him, and much people followed. And when he came close to the gate of the city, behold, there was a dead man that was carried out. And this man was the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And much of the people of the city were with her to try to comfort her. You can imagine the tragedy and the loss that she would feel to be alone now and losing even her son. You know, it's so wrong when a child dies before the parent. It is just such a tragedy. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her, and he said, "Weep not." And he came and touched the bier, and they that bare him stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And he that was dead sat up and began to speak, and he delivered him to his mother. And there came a fear on all, and they glorified God, saying, "This that a great prophet is risen up among us, and that God has visited his people." Yes, God himself, this is how he was. He just lamented the sorrow of this mother. And she didn't have to ask him. He went to her. And he realized how she felt and the tragedy this was because he had an aspect of humaneness in him. And so real men, I believe, try to imitate and emulate this aspect of Jesus Christ. That is, we want to be strong and we want to work hard and we want to do these things and we want to sacrifice for our family and our society, but we also want to have compassion on others who are suffering or who don't have all that we have. So let's go to Proverbs 30. Proverbs 30. There is the face of an eagle, and this portrays the spiritual depth of Christ, and this is reflected in the Gospel of John. But it says in Proverbs 30 and verse 18, Proverbs 30 and verse 18, "There are three things which are too wonderful for me, yes, four, that I know not." And then he says, "The way of an eagle in the air." And I think this is so beautiful. Let's go to Job for a moment. The imagery of an eagle. Job 39. "It can fly so high and see such minute details from enormous heights." Verse 27. "Does an eagle mount up at your command?" No. "But she makes her nest on high. She dwells and abides on the rock, upon the crag of a rock, in the strong place. And from there she sees the prey, and her eyes behold far off. And her young ones also suck up blood where the slain are, and there is she." And the point is that the eagle's eyes are interesting, that they're mounted on the opposite sides, like so many are, and yet it can see forward. And it has amazing eyesight. They say that most birds have keener sight than humans, but they say that the eagle has the keenest sight of all that flies. And it pictures this majestic ability to have insight, able to climb into the heavens far above the sight of men. The eagle can look into the sun and is not blinded by it. It can turn and look back and see the minute fish in the river down below, thousands of feet below. And we use the phrase, don't we? soaring with eagles. And by that we mean flying higher than the others. And there is a dignity and there is a superiority to the eagle, isn't it? And so we have that as an emblem for the United States because of what it represents and reflects. Higher, something higher than man. It's reaching for divinity. It's about one who lives beyond this earth and one who has penetrating sight that can look into the hearts and the minds of human beings, look into the heart of a matter and understand it fully. And so we see this, that these faces that surround Christ are reflecting four aspects of him. We see that the Gospels are also reflecting these very same ones. They're both in the same order. The Gospels follow the same order as those faces do. Matthew reveals Christ as the King, Mark the untiring servant, Luke the perfect man, and the Gospel of John is unique and totally different from the others, which are synoptics and go through chronology. John goes through what? Theology. He is focused on that which is spiritual, and he is written, as it says by Eusebius, John wrote a spiritual gospel because he was on such a higher level spiritually. And so let's go to John 1. Look at the focus of the writer of this gospel, where he's coming from. He shows another side of Jesus Christ that is not emphasized in the other gospels in the same way. Verse 1, John 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. And in him was life, and the life was the light of men. John was so close to Jesus Christ, he put his head on the Savior's chest. And Christ loved him in a unique way. And I think this gospel shows us the reason why. I really do. John's gospel is the most deeply spiritual of all. And he speaks of an awareness of how great Christ really was. He was no less than the Creator God in the flesh. And he makes this clear over and over and over in his scriptures. And he's portrayed as the truth, the life, the only way to God. Let's go to John 20. John 20, and there the book concludes with the purpose for this gospel being written. And he says in verse 31 this: But these things are written that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. And so this gospel portrays really this deep insight of who Christ really was. And it was for the purpose of forming deep and abiding faith in the individuals who read this. Believe this. It's all through this. These different miracles he performed, everything he did, he wrote these things so that people would believe. And it is the basis of faith. And that's what a true man has. He isn't crippled by threats. He isn't crippled by difficulty. He's not crippled by some kind of conflict in life. A real man, a Christian man, believes in God to such a degree he commits his life to him and believes whatever happens to him is for his best interests. And a man who's a real man, a Christian man, has that kind of faith and belief. God can do anything. He's sovereign in the universe. And so he exudes a confidence. He doesn't go through life timidly. He goes through life with confidence. And he has a bounce in his step. He has a purpose and a direction, and he feels it and he believes it. That's what a real man is. He believes in and trusts and loves the Almighty God. And this faith leads him to have the courage and the nobility of a king. And it leads him to serve in untiring service towards others. And it humbly leads him to compassion and empathy for others. And these are the makings of a real man. And Christ is our example. And as it says, we are to walk as he walked. As our culture cascades into the end of the age, And as it seems to attempt to emasculate mankind, men, let us who are the men in God's church resist this. Let's not let it affect us. Let's look at the Christ of the Gospels. Look at the Christ that is pictured by these four symbols. And let's strive to be that man. Let's be a real man. Let's stand up and be the man that God intended us to be.